Hello there. You're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Monday, the 15th of November. Today, I'm joined by Stuart Dickens, who is a Watson's Daily ambassador. Hi there, Stuart. How are you doing today?
Hi, Peter. Yeah, I'm very well. How are you doing?
Yep, good. All good here. Thank you. What story did you find most interesting in today's Watson's Daily?
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of good stories today, but the one which really stood out for me today was the news that Johnson & Johnson are planning to split their consumer-based business from their pharmaceutical/medical service business to create two separate companies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is big news. I mean, obviously, it's not going to happen overnight, but, it is something that... big companies splitting up seems like a lot of them. There's a lot of it about at the moment, isn't there?
No, definitely. I think it's very interesting to see Johnson & Johnson following suit to a number of other companies. Obviously a very, very old company founded in 1886, one of the world's largest and largest pharmaceutical companies. So it'll be interesting to see how these two new divisions kind of interact.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there seems to be, when I said earlier, there's a lot of it about. Obviously, we're coming into this week off the back of very recent news where we heard about Toshiba. So you should say Toshiba, by the way, just for those people out there. I'm half Japanese, right? So you know it's real. Toshiba. That's splitting up, and then the other one is, of course, General Electric, or GE, from America. It just seems to me that these companies, they do tend to go through waves. So at one point you have bigger is better, and the reason for that is because the thinking behind it is, if you have a broad array of different divisions, it means that your earnings are perhaps less volatile than they would be if you put all your eggs in one basket. But the problem is that once you get to a certain size, then it becomes very unwieldy, and then you don't know where anything is coming from. Well, I mean, you do, but I mean, it's a lot harder to see. But I don't know. Do you think there are any particular advantages at all of them, splitting up the divisions?
Yeah, I mean, it's reported that Johnson & Johnson's consumer unit sales only rose 1.1% to $15 billion last year in comparison to the pharmaceutical unit, which rose 8%.
Yeah.
So I guess it seems the company may seek to gain a greater amount of investment through the demerger, because investors will want to invest, in distinct business units rather than just one whole company as a whole.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And certainly... another one of these advantages is that you have of splitting up is that the investment case. So from an investment point of view, the investment case becomes a lot simpler. It's cleaner because you're not lumping in unattractive businesses with really exciting growth businesses, or you're doing less of it. So from a company point of view, and actually, I suppose, an investor point of view, you want to reduce the volatility of your earnings. But having said that, from an investment point of view, it's easier to invest in a purer play. Let's take a different example, right? So if you're in the world of advertising, do you go for a, do you invest in a company that, let's say, has 50% of its revenues from digital advertising and 50% from traditional kind of TV, print advertising, that sort of thing? Or do you invest money in a digital only advertising company? So those kinds of things, it depends. I mean, you could invest in either, depending on what your investment criteria are, but at least then you have the choice. So I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I was saying to Stuart earlier, saying to you earlier on, that when I was a stockbroker, I used to get sent out to Tokyo quite regularly. Not because they didn't like me, I hasten to understand, and I hasten to add, but it was more of a case to, I would go out there, I would see probably 5 to 6 companies every day, do a report on them, come back, and then I would speak to investors and say, you know, these are the companies I like, and I think you should maybe think of buying them, etc. All the companies I used to see at least the IR team, so that's investor relations, and they always used to answer questions from investors. So I used to see IR or maybe chief exec or chairman of these companies. But the IR, or they always used to have a folder of a massive folder of facts, and usually that folder was about sort of slightly bigger than A4 size and about 4 inches thick. And you'd ask them some question about, I don't know, dividend policy or something, and they'd immediately flick to, I mean, I reckon they must have exams where they say, tell us which page has the latest dividend policy or something, because they used to be pretty quick with this. But I remember that when I went to see companies like Toshiba or Hitachi, they would have two folders because they were so complicated. But yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, this is going to sound like a dodgy question, but it's not. So, Stuart, do you think small is beautiful?
I think it depends on the circumstances, maybe.
Talking corporate, of course, you know.
Yeah, I think it depends on the circumstances, but it's interesting to see how this pans out. I think it gives them a chance to really knuckle down and focus on the innovation and the technology side of what they do, which I think is really exciting. I think it's kind of the sexy bit of it as well. You know, I think there's kind of a movement, especially in the industry, to kind of depart from consumer-based products. I mean, I think it's very recent. Pfizer and Merck decided to divide their consumer businesses as well to concentrate on this side of the market. And, you know, given that there's been a few lawsuits over the years, you know, I think there's a recent allegation claiming, you know, Johnson & Johnson's talc-based products cause cancer. Mm-hmm. I think there is a trend of these companies trying to depart from this side of the industry to focus on, you know, the tech side.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I do think that will be that's certainly a very valid point, and maybe, you know, is it now that, yeah, well, maybe it's that they thought that they were going to do this demerger for a while, but maybe wanted to get this you know, this cancer thing over and done with, or at least have the damages decided and then do it. I do wonder though whether, I mean, this company is called Johnson & Johnson, so do you, you know, you divide it into two, do you call one Johnson and then the other one Johnson as well? It's a bit like
maybe
Johnson,
maybe
a,
just
Johnson
called B. John and Johnny, maybe. yeah,
or one called John, the other one called Son. I don't know. But anyway, yes, Johnson and Johnson. But I do think it's very interesting. Potentially, like I say, there seems to be a pattern at the moment of these massive companies getting smaller. We're probably going to see more of it, I would imagine. So I guess what is going to happen now amongst the investor community is they're all going to be trying to guess which one is going to be next. So like, I'll just chuck my hat in the ring, unless it's been done already. I reckon Hitachi, surely. Guys, it's a very complicated company, but so anyway, I'll just go and move on to the next thing. Now the thing is, here on the podcast, okay, the listeners, you'll be glad to know that we put these stories through their paces, right? We put the stories through their paces on the Zoom call that we have just prior to this, and we had a system, didn't we, Stuart? It was decided because Stuart was very decisive, and he said, "Yeah, I'm going to talk about this." But then I was a bit, oh, I don't know, might talk about this or might talk about that. So Stuart, describe the please describe the scientific process that we went through for this.
Well, in the absence of a you know, usual coin toss.
Yeah, I couldn't find any coins around it. That's the thing. This is what COVID's done, digital. Right? I've got no coins. Right, anyway, sorry. Go on.
We basically decided to choose between the two stories. I would think of a number between 1 and 10. And if Peter got the number either side of the number, then we would go with one story. Or otherwise, he would go with the other story.
There you go. So, there you go. It was either that or I played rock, paper, scissors against myself, which I wasn't quite sure whether I'd win that. So the story we are going to go with today is, and by the way, it's just because there were some really interesting stories today. So like there always are, but I think there were just a few that were just vying for attention. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about bikes. There was a very interesting story in the FT today about the bike industry, and they were talking specifically about Look Cycle, which is a French high-end bike company, and they were saying that they reckon that problems, the supply chain problems, are going to continue for another 12 to 18 months, which is quite some time, especially after only last week Halfords said that they are well stocked up for Christmas, ahead of getting all those bikes in stockings, although obviously you can't really do that because that'd be a ridiculously large or elasticated stocking you'd need for that. But, you know, I think that it seems now, I mean, I'm not saying that, I mean, Halfords does sell expensive bikes. But I think that they're more, I would say that Halfords is a bit more commutery rather than sort of race related. And I think the reason why I thought this is quite interesting is they were saying that one of the main reasons why they were having difficulties was because you've got the component manufacturers like Shimano, SRAM and Campagnolo, which I'm going to call Campag because that's what cyclists tend to call Campag. So Campagnolo. So unless you're Italian, potentially. But it's very interesting. I think it's a very interesting. It sounds like these component makers have been very conservative. They've not want to ramp up a production now with a view to potentially the demand dropping off, say, a year or two down the line. So they've been very conservative. That's led to the bottlenecks. And so despite being inundated with orders, because they've been inundated with orders, it's been a tricky time. So supply disruption there. I think this is quite interesting because back in the day, going into the end of 2019, so going into, if you cast your minds back to when world pre-COVID, and at the time we were heading into a general election where it was between Corbyn and Bojo, at that point I must say, leading into that, I did think that we had reached peak cycling, because I feel that, and I'm saying this as an ex-triathlete and cyclist, that it was peak at 2012, the London Olympics. You had Wigo, winning the gold medal. He just won the Tour de France. He was world champ. I mean, he won everything. And I think lots of people got behind that. There were loads of people. I mean, I live in Guildford. I used to train on Box Hill. And in the run up to the Olympics and since then, Box Hill has become a bit like the M25 in terms of the number of cyclists that are going up, are going around it. And I just think that it, getting towards the end of 2019, I wondered whether people's interest was waning. And I've always said, I feel like you have to, in order to make proper money from cycling, you need to target the high end, because I think commuters tend to buy one bike and then that's it, just leave it and just ride and ride and ride, and you might get some maintenance out of it. But in terms of high end and making money, I feel that if you talk to a lot of cyclists and triathletes who do it, they'll so to a commuter, you say, do you have a bike? And they say yes, and that's it, you know, end of conversation. If you talk to a triathlete or a cyclist and you say, it's not that, it'll be like, how many bikes do you have? And they'll say, you know, especially with a triathlete, you'll say, oh yeah, I've got a time trial bike, I've got a winter bike, I've got a cyclocross bike, I've got this, that, and the other bike. Oh, and I've got a frame from some random year, ridden by some random French bloke who I stick on my wall as a piece of art or something. You know, all this. By the way, if I've offended anyone by talking about that, I'm really sorry. I know a lot of my mates have this sort of thing, so I'm really sorry. I don't mean anything by it. But I'm just saying that I think that there's a lot of money being spent on this sort of stuff. And I thought that was peak. We were going. But then we had coronavirus hit. Everyone decided they wanted to commute. And that happened. So, Stuart, are you a cyclist at all? Have you commuted in, under pedal power at all? Or are you more of a public transport kind of guy?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So yeah, prior to deciding to retrain,
yeah,
I used to live in Fulham, which is in West London. For any of those who don't know that, and I used to work in East London, so it was quite far away. So I had to commute to Shoreditch, and nice. The famous District Line isn't too great in the morning, and my kind of commute would be probably about an hour and 20. So decided to start going in by bike, but I mean I think the cycle time was 40 minutes there, 40 minutes back.
That's right.
Well, yeah, I mean it's fine for you a triathlon, but for me who plays 80 minutes of very substandard rugby on the weekend, yeah. I probably wasn't quite up to fitness.
Yeah,
didn't stick very long, but I agree with what you said. I think over COVID, especially as everything kind of opened up, I think everyone really kind of looked to cycling as kind of a new sport to do, something different to just going out and walking about. I remember when everything kind of started lifting up a little bit, the wait time to get my bike service was probably about 3 weeks for our local place. But as time's gone on, I think it's kind of died down somewhat. So I appreciate what these high-end suppliers are saying, but I think the difference with Halfords and them is Halfords are providing what I would be imagined just usual bikes,
the workhorse.
Yeah, nothing too special. Whereas some of these bikes can go up to £8,000-£10,000. Yeah,
indeed. Cases. Indeed, they can. And I just have to ask. I mean, as you commuted into Shoreditch, did you find, because you were commuting in by bike, did you find yourself fighting the urge to have a man bun, beard, and a fixed wheel bike, or did you manage to sort of fight against it? I don't know. Just to fit in with the local sort of cafe culture.
No, I don't quite have the man bun, unfortunately. But I did find myself, purchasing a few oak flat whites or.
Of course, yes. The elite and obscure coffee sort of thing. Yeah, no, good. I mean, that's all part of it. It's all part of the fun. Not by the way, not that I did. I was very completely the opposite, very short hair, and stuff. Although I do like coffee, and I have in the past when I was training for stuff, I did used to commute in by bike from Guildford to London. So I used to get up at 4, leave at 4:30, and cycle into London, which took me about 2 hours. It was a bit dark, I found, at that point. It was so I started in November, and a little bit concerning because there were no streetlights. So, and all the cars at that point, I say all the cars, you know, all one or two that I came across at that point in the morning, weren't expecting to see a fat bloke on a bike riding along. You know, some of them were visibly surprised. But anyway, well, that's a subject for another another podcast. riding in the dark, or maybe even a song, perhaps. I don't know.
Being a stockbroker working, you know, X amount of hours a day wasn't enough. You know, you just wanted to fit a 4-hour commute in by cycling.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I must say I did wimp out on the way back. I used to cycle to Waterloo and then put the bike on the train. So, I mean, I was a bit of a wimp, really. But yeah. Anyway, on that note and on that bombshell, I think we might as well come to an end to this today. But you know, thank you very much, Stuart, for your time on here today. And Stuart and I will be back tomorrow to talk about more exciting stuff from Watson's Daily. Don't worry, there won't be any more cycling stuff tomorrow, I promise. Anyway, thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much for listening. Oh, and by the way, just to say that the event that we had on the weekend with Jake Shocker went very well. And if any of you listening to this listen to that, thank you very much for coming. It was really good fun. And hopefully a lot of people got a lot from it. But thank you very much. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day. Many thanks. Bye.